an adventure to share.
While Eve has a glory for relationship, that is not all she is essential for. Back in Genesis, when God sets his image bearers on the earth, he gives them their mission.
And God said, "Let us make a human in our image, by our likeness, to hold sway over the fish of the sea, and the fowl of the heavens, and the cattle, and the wild beasts, and all the crawling things that crawl upon the earth." And God created the human in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and conquer it and hold sway over the fish of the sea and the fowl of the heavens and every beast that crawls upon the earth." Genesis 1:26-28.
Call it the human mission, to be all and do all God sent us here to do. And notice, the mission to be fruitful and conquer and hold sway is given both to Adam and to Eve. And God said to them. Eve is standing right there when God gives the world over to us. She has a vital role to play. She is a partner in this great adventure. All that human beings were intended to do here on earth, all the creativity and exploration, all the battle and rescue and nurture, we were intended to do it together. In fact, not only is Eve needed, she is desperately needed.
When God creates Eve, he calls her an Azer Kenegdo. "It is not good for the man to be alone. I shall make him an Azer Kenegdo." Genesis 2:18. Hebrew scholar Robert Alter, who has spent years translating the book of Genesis, says that this phrase is notoriously difficult to translate. The various attempts we have in English are helper or companion or the notorious helpmeet. Why are these translations so incredibly wimpy, boring, flat, disappointing? What is a helpmeet, anyway? What little girl dances through the house singing, "One day I shall be a helpmeet"? Companion? A dog can be a companion. Helper? Sounds like hamburger helper. Alter is getting close when he translates it, "sustainer beside him." The word Azer is used only 20 other places in the entire Old Testament. And in every other instance, the person being described is God, when you need him to come through for you desperately. "There is no one like the God of Jeshurun, who rides on the heavens to help you. Blessed are you, O Israel, who is like you, a people saved by the Lord. He is your shield and helper and your glorious sword." Deuteronomy 33:26-29.
I lift my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. Psalm 121:1-2.
May the Lord answer you when you are in distress. May the name of the God of Jacob protect you. May he send you help. Psalm 20:1-2.
We wait in hope for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. Psalm 33:20.
O house of Israel, trust in the Lord. He is their help and shield. O house of Aaron, trust in the Lord. He is their help and shield. You who fear him, trust in the Lord. He is their help and shield. Psalm 115:9-11. Most of the context of these verses are life and death, by the way. And God is your only hope, your Azer. If he is not there beside you, you are dead. A better translation, therefore, of Azer would be lifesaver. Kenegdo means alongside or opposite to, a counterpart. You see, the life God calls us to is not a safe life. Ask Joseph, Abraham, Moses, Deborah, Esther. Ask any of the friends of God from the Old Testament. Ask Mary and Lazarus. Ask Peter, James, and John. Ask Priscilla and Aquila. Ask any of the friends of God in the New Testament. God calls us to a life involving frequent risks and many dangers. Why else would we need him to be our Azer? You don't need a lifesaver if your mission is to be couch potato. You need an Azer when your life is in constant danger. Picture the character Arwen in the mythic trilogy, The Lord of the Rings. Arwen is a princess, a beautiful and brave elf maiden. She comes into the story in the nick of time to rescue the little hobbit Frodo just as the poisoned wound moving toward his heart is about to claim him.
He's fading. He's not going to last. We must get him to my father. I've been looking for you for 2 days. There are 5 wraiths behind you. Where the other 4 are, I do not know.
Stay with the hobbits. I'll send horses for you.
I'm the faster rider. I'll take him.
The road is too dangerous.
I do not fear them.
Arwen, ride hard. Don't look back.
It is Arwen, not the warrior Aragorn who rides with glory and speed. She is Frodo's only hope. She is the one entrusted with his life and with him the future of all Middle-earth. She is his Aesir Kinegdo. That longing in the heart of a woman to share life together is a great adventure. That comes straight from the heart of God, who also longs for this. He does not want to be an option in our lives. He does not want to be an appendage, a tag-along. Neither does any woman. God is essential. He wants us to need him desperately. Eve is essential. She has an irreplaceable role to play. And so you'll see that women are endowed with fierce devotion, an ability to suffer great hardships, a vision to make the world a better place. Beauty to unveil.
Beauty. I just let out a deep sigh that we even need to explain how beauty is so absolutely essential to God only shows how dull we have grown to him, to the world in which we live, and to Eve. Far too many years of our own spiritual lives were lived with barely a nod to beauty, to the central role that beauty plays in the life of God and in our lives. We held to the importance of truth and goodness, but had you suggested beauty to us, we might have nodded, but not really understood. How could we have missed this? Beauty is essential to God. Now, that's not putting it strongly enough. Beauty is the essence of God. The first way we know this is through nature, the world God has given us. Scripture says that the created world is filled with the glory of God, Isaiah 6:3. In what way? Primarily through its beauty. We had a wet spring here in Colorado, and the wildflowers are coming up everywhere. Lupin and wild iris, Shasta daisy, and a dozen others. The aspens have their heart-shaped leaves again, trembling in the slightest breeze. Massive thunderclouds are rolling in, bringing with them the glorious sunsets they magnify. The earth in summer is brimming with beauty. Beauty of such magnificence and variety and unembarrassed lavishness. Ripe beauty, lush beauty, beauty given to us with such generosity and abundance, it is almost scandalous. Nature is not primarily functional. It is primarily beautiful. Stop for a moment and let that sink in. We're so used to evaluating everything and everyone by their usefulness. This thought will take a minute or two to begin to dawn on us. Nature is not primarily functional. It is primarily beautiful, which is to say, beauty is, in and of itself, a great and glorious good, something we need in large and daily doses, for our God has seen fit to arrange for it. Nature, at the height of its glory, shouts, "Beauty is essential," revealing that beauty is the essence of God. The whole world is full of his glory.
Next, there are the visions given to John, who was taken in the Spirit to behold God. As we can only imagine, he finds it hard to put into words what he saw. He keeps using the word like, as if grasping to find any comparison that might help us appreciate what he beheld. The one sitting on the throne was as brilliant as gemstones, jasper and carnelian, and the glow of an emerald encircled his throne like a rainbow. In front of the throne was a shiny sea of glass, sparkling like crystal. Revelations 4:3-6. Is there any doubt that the God John beheld was beautiful beyond description? But of course, God must be even more glorious than this glorious creation, for it foretells or displays the glory that is God's. John describes God as radiant as gemstones, as richly adorned in golds and reds and greens and blues, shimmering as crystal. Why, these are the very things that Cinderella is given, the very things women still prefer to adorn themselves when they want to look their finest. Huh. And isn't that just what a woman longs to hear? You are radiant this evening. You are absolutely breathtaking. Saints from ages past would speak of the highest pleasures of heaven as simply beholding the beauty of God, the beatific vision. The reason a woman wants a beauty to unveil, the reason she asks, "Do you delight in me?" is simply that God does as well. God is captivating beauty. As David prays, "One thing I ask of the Lord, this is what I seek, that I may gaze upon the beauty of the Lord." Psalm 27:4. Can there be any doubt that God wants to be worshipped, that He wants to be seen, and for us to be captivated by what we see?
But in order to make the matter perfectly clear, God has given us Eve, the crowning touch of creation. Beauty is the essence of a woman. We want to be perfectly clear that we mean both a physical beauty and a soulful or spiritual beauty. The one depends upon and flows out of the other. Yes, the world cheapens and prostitutes beauty, making it all about a perfect figure few women can attain. But Christians minimize it too, or over-spiritualize it, making it all about character. We must recover the prize of beauty. The church must take it back. Beauty is too vital to lose. God gave Eve a beautiful form and a beautiful spirit. She expresses beauty in both. Better, she expresses beauty simply in who she is. Like God, it is her essence. Stacy and I just spent a weekend together in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which boasts the third largest gathering of art galleries in the world. We love to wander for hours through those galleries and gardens, looking for those works of art that particularly capture us. Towards the afternoon of our second day, Stacy asked me, "Have you seen one painting of a naked man?" The point was startling. After days of looking at maybe 1,000 pieces of art, we had not seen one painting devoted to the beauty of the naked masculine form. Not one. Granted, there are a few examples down through history, but only a few. However, the beauty of woman was celebrated everywhere, hundreds of times over in paintings and sculptures. There is a reason for this.
For one thing, men look ridiculous lying on a bed buck naked, half covered with a sheet. It doesn't fit the essence of masculinity. Something in you wants to say, "Get up already and get a job, cut the grass, get to work." For Adam is captured best in motion, doing something. His essence is strength and action. That is what he speaks to the world. He bears the image of a God who is a warrior. On behalf of God, Adam says, "God will come through. God is on the move." That is why a passive man is so disturbing. His passivity defies his very essence. It violates the way he bears God's image. A passive man says, "God will not come through. He is not acting on your behalf."
On the other hand, and bear with us a moment, but Eve just doesn't look right in a scene of brutal combat or chopping a tree down. From time immemorial, when artists have tried to capture the essence of Eve, they have painted her or photographed her or sculpted her at rest. There is no agenda here, no social stigmatizing or cultural pressure. This is true across all cultures and down through all time. What have the artists seen that we have not? Eve speaks something differently to the world than Adam does, through her beauty.
Why beauty matters. Every experience of beauty points to eternity. Hans Urs von Balthasar.
Beauty is powerful. It may be the most powerful thing on earth. It is dangerous because it matters. Let us try and explain why. First, beauty speaks. Oxford Bishop Richard Herries wrote, "It is the beauty of the created order which gives an answer to our questionings about God." And we do have questions, don't we? Questions born out of our disappointments, our sufferings, our fears. Augustine said he found answers to his questions in the beauty of the world. I said to all these things, "Tell me of my God, who you are not. Tell me something about him." And with a great voice, they cried out, "He made us." Psalm 99:3. My question was the attention I gave to them, and their response was their beauty. And what does beauty say to us? Think of what it's like to be caught in traffic for more than an hour. Horns blaring, people shouting obscenities, exhaust pouring in your windows, suffocating you. Then remember what it's like to come into a beautiful place, a garden, or a meadow, or a quiet beach. There is room for your soul. It expands. You can breathe again. You can rest. It is good. All is well. I sit outside on a summer evening and just listen and behold and drink it all in, and my heart begins to quiet, and peace begins to come into my soul. My heart tells me that all will be well, as Julian of Norwich concluded, and all manner of things will be well. That is what beauty says. All shall be well. And this is what it's like to be with a woman at rest, a woman comfortable in her feminine beauty. She is enjoyable to be with. She is lovely. In her presence, your heart stops holding its breath. You relax and believe once again that all will be well. And this is also why a woman who is striving is so disturbing. For a woman who is not at rest in her heart says to the world, "All is not well. Things are not going to turn out all right." Like a fountain troubled, as Shakespeare said, muddy, ill-seeming, thick, bereft of beauty. We need what beauty speaks. What it says is hard to put into words, but part of its message is that all is well. All shall be well.
Beauty also invites. Recall what it is like to hear a truly beautiful piece of music. It captures you. You want to sit down and just drink it in. We buy the CD and play it many times over. This is not visual, by the way, showing us that beauty is deeper than looks. Music like this commands your attention, invites you to come more deeply into it. The same is true of a beautiful garden or a scene in nature. You want to enter in, explore, partake of it, feast upon it. We describe a great book as captivating. It draws you in, holds your attention. You can't wait to get back to it. Spend some time with it. All of the responses that God wants of us. All of the responses a woman wants, too. Beauty invites.
Beauty nourishes. It is a kind of food our souls crave. A woman's breast is among the loveliest of all God's works. And it is with her breast she nourishes a baby. A stunning picture of the way in which beauty itself nourishes us. In fact, a woman's body is one of the most beautiful of all God's creations. Too much of eternity, as William Blake said, for the eye of man. It nourishes, it offers life. That is such a profound metaphor for beauty itself. As C.S. Lewis said, "We do not merely want to see beauty, though God knows even that is bounty enough. We want something else which we can hardly put into words, to be united with the beauty that we see, to pass into it, to receive it into ourselves, the weight of glory."
Beauty comforts. There is something profoundly healing about it. Have you ever wondered why we send flowers to the bereaved? In the midst of their suffering and loss, only a gift of beauty says enough or says it right.
After I lost my dearest friend Brent, there were months where only beauty helped. I could not hear words of counsel. I could not read or even pray. Only beauty helped. There's a touching story told from the hospitals of World War II where a young and badly wounded soldier was brought in from a hellish week of fighting. After doing what she could for him, the nurse inquired if there was anything else she could do. "Yes," he said. "Could you just put on some lipstick while I watch?" Beauty comforts. It soothes the soul. Beauty inspires. After beholding all the marvelous wonders of the creation of Narnia, as told in The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Lewis, the cabbie says, "Glory be! I'd have been a better man all my life if I'd have known there were things like this." Or as Jack Nicholson says to Helen Hunt at the end of the movie, As Good As It Gets, "You make me want to be a better man." Isn't it true? Think of what it might have been like to have been in the presence of a woman like Mother Teresa. Her life was so beautiful, and it called us to something higher. A teacher in the inner city explained to us why he insisted on putting a fountain and flowers in the courtyard of the building, because these children need to be inspired. They need to know that life can be better. Beauty inspires.
Beauty is transcendent. It is our most immediate experience of the eternal. Think of what it's like to behold a gorgeous sunset or the ocean at dawn. Remember the ending of a great story? We yearn to linger, to experience it all our days. Sometimes the beauty is so deep it pierces us with longing. For what? For life as it was meant to be. Beauty reminds us of an Eden we have never known, but somehow know our hearts were created for. Beauty speaks of heaven to come, when all shall be beautiful. It haunts us with eternity. Beauty says there is a glory calling to you. And if there is a glory, there is a source of glory. What great goodness could have possibly created this? What generosity gave us this to behold? Beauty draws us to God.
All these things are true for any experience of beauty, but they are especially true when we experience the beauty of a woman, her eyes, her form, her voice, her heart, her spirit, her life. She speaks all of this far more profoundly than anything else in all creation because she is incarnate. She is personal. It flows to us from an immortal being. She is beauty through and through. For where is any author in the world teaches such beauty as a woman's eye? Shakespeare. Beauty is, without question, the most essential and the most misunderstood of all of God's qualities, all feminine qualities, too. We know it has caused untold pain in the lives of women, but even there, something is speaking. Why so much heartache over beauty? Women don't ache over being geniuses or fabulous hockey players. Women ache over the issue of beauty. They ache to be beautiful, to believe they are beautiful, and they worry over keeping it if ever they can find it. I was just at Starbucks and overheard a conversation between two women in their late 50s sitting at the table next to mine. The subject? Weight and diets. Their struggle with the issue of beauty.
A woman knows, down in her soul, that she longs to bring beauty to the world. She might be mistaken on how, something every woman struggles with, but she longs for a beauty to unveil. This is not just culture or the need to get a man. This is in her heart, part of her design.
But why a beauty to unveil?
One of the deepest ways a woman bears the image of God is in her mystery. By mystery, we don't mean forever beyond your knowing, but something to be explored. It is the glory of God to conceal a matter, says the book of Proverbs. To search out a matter is the glory of kings. God yearns to be known, but he wants to be sought after by those who would know him. He says, "You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart." Jeremiah 29:13. There is dignity here. God does not throw himself at any passerby. He is no harlot. If you would know him, you must love him. You must seek him with your whole heart. This is crucial to any woman's soul, not to mention her sexuality. You cannot simply have me. You must seek me, pursue me. I won't let you in unless I know you love me. Is not the Trinity a great mystery? Not something to be solved, but known with ever-deepening pleasure and awe, something to be enjoyed. Just like God, a woman is not a problem to be solved, but a vast wonder to be enjoyed. This is so true of her sexuality. Few women can or even want to just do it. foreplay is crucial to her heart, the whispering and loving and exploring of one another that culminates in intercourse. That is a picture of what it means to love her soul. She yearns to be known, and that takes time and intimacy. It requires an unveiling. As she is sought after, she reveals more of her beauty. As she unveils her beauty, she draws us to know her more deeply.
Whatever else it means to be feminine, it is depth and mystery and complexity with beauty as its very essence. Now, before despair sets in, let us say as clearly as we can, every woman has a beauty to unveil. Every woman. Because she bears the image of God. She doesn't have to conjure it, go get it from a salon, have plastic surgery or breast implants. No. No, beauty is an essence that is given to every woman at her creation.
In closing, it is very important for you to pause just now and ask yourself, what did I hear them say? We did not say that a woman is prized only for her good looks. We did not say a woman is here merely to complete a man and therefore a single woman is somehow missing her destiny. What we said was, first, that Eve is the crown of creation. There is something uniquely magnificent and powerful about a woman. We tried to reveal the immeasurable dignity, the holiness of your feminine heart by showing that it is God who longs for romance. It is God who longs to be our Azer. It is God who reveals beauty as essential to life. You are the image bearer of this God. That is why you long for those things too. There is a radiance hidden in your heart that the world desperately needs. Chapter 3. Haunted by a question. I was standing in line at the grocery store buying a few last-minute items when I heard her. "That is the 15-itemer less line, ma'am," she hissed. I looked around wondering who the woman was talking about. My own cart had the required 15 items. I knew it. I had counted them twice to be sure. When she motioned for her husband to look at the wicked infidel, I saw that she was directing her comments at me. Glancing back, I told her that I had only the prescribed 15 items in my cart. She rolled away in an angry huff. Soon she was back in the line next to mine with her husband following. She muttered loudly, accusingly, her voice filled with sarcasm. "She says she only has 15 items." At this point, to say I became defensive is a massive understatement. Rage welled up inside me. I felt hot, surprising myself at the intensity of my reaction. Leaning around the candy bars, I spoke angrily to her. "I do only have 15 items, ma'am. Do you want to come over here and count them?" Her husband held up his hand, signaling me to back off, let it go. Embarrassed, I quieted and then paid for my order, vindicated that there were indeed only 15 items in my cart. Oh, how I wanted to show her my receipt. Driving home, still upset, I had to pull over. I'm shaking. I had just gotten into a fight with a stranger in the grocery store over the 15-item or less line. What was going on? What was that about?
Eve, what happened?
Eve was given to the world as the incarnation of a beautiful, captivating God, a life-offering, life-saving lover, a relational specialist full of tender mercy and hope. Yes, she brought a strength to the world, but not a striving, sharp-edged strength. She was inviting, alluring, captivating. Is that how you experience the women you know? Is that how people experience you? Why do so few women have anything close to a life of romance? Loneliness and emptiness are far more common themes, so entirely common that most women buried their longings for romance long ago and are now living merely to survive, get through the week. And it's not just romance. Why are most of the relationships of women fraught with hardship? Their friendships, their families, their best friends all seem to have come down with a sort of virus that makes them fundamentally unavailable, leaving a woman lonely at the end of the day. Even when relationships are good, it's never enough. Where does this bottomless pit in us come from? And women are tired. We are drained. But it's not from a life of shared adventures. No, the weariness of women comes from lives that are crammed with routine, with chores, with hundreds of demands. As Chekhov said, any idiot can face a crisis. It's the day-to-day living that wears you out. Somehow, somewhere between our youth and yesterday, efficiency has taken the place of adventure. Most women do not feel they are playing an irreplaceable role in a great story. Oh no, we struggle to know if we matter at all. If we are at home, we feel ashamed we don't have a real life in the outside world. We are swallowed by laundry. If we have a career, we feel as though we are missing out on more important matters like marriage and children. We are swallowed by meetings.
A woman's deepest question.
Finally, most women doubt very much that they have any genuine beauty to unveil. It is, in fact, our deepest doubt. When it comes to the issues surrounding beauty, we vacillate between striving and resignation. New diets, new outfits, new hair color, work out, work on your life, try this discipline or that new program for self-improvement. Oh, forget it. Who cares anyway? Put up a shield and get on with life. Hide. Hide in busyness. Hide in church activities. Hide in depression. There is nothing captivating about me. Certainly not inside me. I'll be lucky to pull it off on the outside. When I'm going to a party or gathering or just a dinner at a friend's house, really anywhere I'm meeting other people, I feel nervous. Often I'm not aware of what I'm truly feeling, but I find myself reapplying lipstick in the car on the way. The more nervous I feel, the more lipstick goes on. Getting close to the destination, I reapply more lipstick. A little closer, on goes some more. Turning into their street, on goes another layer of sunset rose or whatever. I clued into this habit some time ago when I caught myself putting on another unnecessary layer. What was I doing? I was afraid. At least if my makeup looks good, something deep inside me reasoned, maybe I won't be exposed, found out, seen. Every woman is haunted by Eve in the core of her being. She knows, if only when she passes a mirror, that she is not what she was meant to be. We are more keenly aware of our own shortcomings than anyone else. Remembering the glory that was once ours awakens my heart to an ache that has long gone unfulfilled. It's almost too much to hope for, too much to have lost.
You see, every little girl and every little boy is asking one fundamental question. But they are very different questions depending on whether you are a little boy or a little girl. Little boys want to know, do I have what it takes? All that rough and tumble, all that daring and superhero dress up, all of that is a boy seeking to prove that he does have what it takes. He was made in the image of a warrior god. Nearly all a man does is fueled by his search for validation, that longing he carries for an answer to his question.
Little girls want to know, am I lovely? The twirling skirts, the dress up, the longing to be pretty and to be seen, that is what that's all about. We are seeking an answer to our question. When I was a girl of maybe 5 years old, I remember standing on the top of the coffee table at my grandparents' house and singing my heart out. I wanted to capture attention, especially my father's attention. I wanted to be captivating. We all did. But for most of us, the answer to our question when we were young was no. There is nothing captivating about you. Get off the coffee table. Nearly all a woman does in her adult life is fueled by her longing to be delighted in, her longing to be beautiful, to be irreplaceable, to have her question answered yes. Why does the question linger so? Why haven't we been able to find and rest in a wonderful, personal answer for our own hearts?
The fall of Eve. When the world was young and we were innocent, both man and woman, we were naked and unashamed. Genesis 2:25. Nothing to hide, simply glorious. And while that world was young and we too were young and beautiful and full of life, a corner was turned. Something happened which we have heard about but never really fully understood, or we would see it playing itself out every day of our lives. And more important, we would also see the chances given to us every day to reverse what happened. Now the serpent was the shrewdest of the creatures the Lord God had made. Really? He asked the woman, did God really say you must not eat of any of the fruit in the garden?
Of course we may eat it, the woman told him. It's only the fruit from the tree at the center of the garden that we are not allowed to eat. God says we must not eat it or even touch it, or we will die.
You won't die, the serpent hissed. God knows that your eyes will be opened when you eat it. You will become just like God, knowing everything, both good and evil. And the woman was convinced. The fruit looked so fresh and delicious, and it would make her so wise. So she ate some of the fruit. She also gave some to her husband, who was with her. Then he ate it too. Genesis 3, verses 1 through 6.
Alas, there are no words. Wail, beat your chest, fall to your knees, let out a long, lonesome howl of bitter remorse. The woman was convinced? That's it? Just like that, in a matter of moments? Convinced of what? Look in your own heart. You'll see. Convinced that God was holding out on her. Convinced that she could not trust his heart towards her. Convinced that in order to have the best possible life, she must take matters into her own hands. And so she did. She is the first to fall. In disobeying God, she also violated her very essence. Eve is supposed to be Adam's Ezer Kenegdo. Like one who comes to save, she is to bring him life, invite him to life. Instead, she invited him to his death.
Now, to be fair, Adam doesn't exactly ride to her rescue. Let me ask you a question. Where is Adam while the serpent is tempting Eve? He's standing right there. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. The Hebrew for with her means right there, elbow to elbow. Adam isn't away in another part of the forest. He has no alibi. He is standing right there, watching the whole thing unravel. What does he do? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. He says not a word, doesn't lift a finger. He won't risk, he won't fight, and he won't rescue Eve. Our first father, the first real man, gave in to paralysis. He denied his very nature and went passive. And every man after him, every son of Adam, carries in his heart now the same failure. Every man repeats the sin of Adam every day. We won't risk, we won't fight, and we won't rescue Eve. We truly are a chip off the old block. You can see this play itself out every day. Men, just when you need them to come through for you, check out. They disappear. They go silent and passive. He won't talk to me, is many a woman's lament. They won't fight.
And women? We tend to be grasping, reaching, controlling. We are often enchanted, like Eve, so easily falling prey to the lies of our enemy. Having forfeited our confidence in God, we believe that in order to have the life we want, we must take matters into our own hands. And we ache with an emptiness nothing seems able to fill.
The curse. To the woman he said, I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. To Adam he said, because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you. Genesis 3, verses 16 through 18. Now, it would be good for us to give careful attention to all that has unfolded here, especially the curses God pronounced, for the story explains our lives today, east of Eden. For one thing, The curse on Adam cannot be limited only to actual thorns and thistles. If that were so, then every man who chooses not to be a farmer gets to escape the curse. Take a white-collar job and you're scot-free. No, the meaning is deeper, and the implications are for every son of Adam. Man is cursed with futility and failure. Life is going to be hard for a man now in the place he will feel it most. Failure is a man's worst fear.
In just the same way, the curse for Eve and all her daughters cannot be limited only to babies and marriage. For if that were true, then every single woman without children gets to escape the curse. Not so. The meaning is deeper, and the implications are for every daughter of Eve. Woman is cursed with loneliness, relational heartache, with the urge to control, especially her man, and with the dominance of men, which is not how things were meant to be, and we are not saying it is a good thing. It is a fruit of the fall and a sad fact of history. Isn't it true? Aren't your deepest worries and heartaches relational? Aren't they connected to someone? Even when things are good, is your vast capacity for intimacy ever filled in a lasting way? There is an emptiness in us that we continually try to feed. And can't you see how much you need to have things under your control, whether it's a project or a ministry or a marriage? Are you comfortable trusting your well-being to someone else? And haven't you felt this is a man's world, felt your vulnerability as a woman to be a liability? Most women hate their vulnerability. We are not inviting. We are guarded. Most of our energy is spent trying to hide our true selves and control our worlds to have some sense of security.
When a man goes bad, as every man has in some way gone bad after the fall, what is most deeply marred is his strength. He either becomes a passive, weak man, strength surrendered, or he becomes a violent, driven man, strength unglued. When a woman falls from grace, what is most deeply marred is her tender vulnerability, beauty that invites to life. She becomes either a dominating and controlling woman, or a desolate, needy, mousy woman, or some odd combination of both, depending on her circumstances.
Dominating women.
Think for a moment about the characters of women you dislike, even despise, in movies. That seems a more charitable place to start. After all, they are fictional characters. In The Horse Whisperer, Annie McLean, played by Kristen Scott Thomas, is a sharp, sophisticated New York professional, the editor of a leading women's magazine. She is also an incredibly controlling woman. Annie's daughter is hospitalized in critical condition following a riding accident that takes the life of her best friend, claims her leg, and terribly injures her horse. Understandably, Annie is shaken to her core. But the way she handles her crisis is to dominate. The doctors, the nurses, her husband, even her maimed daughter. At one point, she notices her daughter's IV bag is running low.
You can't leave it to these people.
She steps into the hall, apprehends the first nurse coming by.
Excuse me, my daughter needs a new IV.
Yes, I know. We have her down.
Well, I'd like you to take care of it now, please.
Please is a barely veiled threat, more like, or else. Annie walks back into the room and explains to her embarrassed husband.
You have to stay on top of these people constantly.
She needs no one. She is in charge, on top of things constantly. She is a woman who knows how to get what she wants. Some of us might even admire that. But consider this. There is nothing merciful about her, nothing tender, and certainly nothing vulnerable. She has forsaken essential aspects of her femininity. And then there is the despicable Mrs. John Dashwood in Sense and Sensibility. John Dashwood's father dies at the beginning of the story, leaving his wife and three daughters to the care of his only son, to whom he has bequeathed his entire estate. But with his dying breath, he has commanded that the women be financially provided for through the goodwill of his son. During the carriage ride home from the funeral, Mrs. Dashwood, the conniving and greedy sister-in-law, spins a web of manipulation around her husband, John, and by the time the ride is over, both mother and sisters are penniless. Think of Tom Cruise's fiancée at the opening of Jerry Maguire, the one who decks him. "I'm not going to let you do this to me, Jerry." Or Rose's mother in Titanic, "We have to survive." That line is also said by the horrid mother in Strictly Ballroom, and all those villains like Cruella de Vil and Esmeralda, "Mirror, mirror on the wall." Notice also that most of the wicked witches are women, or stepmothers. Have you ever wondered why it was that for years, until the feminist movement, it might be noted with some irony, hurricanes were named after women? Now sure, a calculating, heartless man makes a frightening villain, but somehow it's even worse when she's a woman?
Fallen Eve controls her relationships. She refuses to be vulnerable. And if she cannot secure her relationships, then she kills her heart's longing for intimacy so that she will be safe and in control. She becomes a woman who doesn't need anyone, especially a man. How this plays out over the course of her life and how the wounds of her childhood shape her heart's convictions are often a complex story, one worth knowing. But beneath it all, behind it all, is a simple truth. Women dominate and control because they fear their vulnerability. Far from God and far from Eden, it seems a perfectly reasonable way to live. But consider also this. Everything that does not come from faith is sin. Romans 14, verse 23. That self-protective way of relating to others has nothing to do with real loving and nothing to do with deeply trusting God. It is our gut-level response to a dangerous world. Now, this is not to say a woman can't be strong. What we are saying is that far too many women forfeit their femininity in order to feel safe and in control. Their strength feels more masculine than feminine. There is nothing inviting or alluring, nothing tender or merciful about them. The archetype would be the infamous Lady Macbeth, who asks the gods to unsex her. Remove her femininity so that she can control the fate of the man in her life and thus secure her own fate. Controlling women are those of us who don't trust anyone else to drive our car, or help us in our kitchen, or speak at our retreat or our meeting, or carry something for us, make a decision that is ours to make, suggest a different dress, agenda, restaurant, route. We room alone when we travel. We plan perfect birthday parties for our children. It might look like we're simply trying to be a good mom or a good friend, but what we often do is arrange other people's lives. Controlling women are the sort of women, as C.S. Lewis said, who live for others. You can tell the others by their hunted expression. Controlling women tend to be very well rewarded in this fallen world of ours. We are the ones to receive corporate promotions. We are the ones put in charge of our women's ministries, can-do, bottom-line, get-it-done kinds of women. Women who have never even considered that our Martha Stewart perfectionism might not be a virtue. We have never considered that by living a controlling and domineering life, we are really refusing to trust our God. And it has also never dawned on us that something precious in us is lost, something the world needs very much from us.
Desolate women. If on the one side of the spectrum we find that Fallen Eve becomes hard and rigid and controlling, then on the other side you find women who are desolate, needy, far too vulnerable. Women like Ruth Jameson in Fried Green Tomatoes. She is naive, lost, bereft of any sense of self. She falls under the abuse of a bad man and hasn't the will to get herself out. Take out the abusive situations and you have a woman like Marianne in Sense and Sensibility, who is far too willing to give herself over to an untrustworthy man. She is desperate to be loved, and she ends up heartbroken. Desolate women are ruled by the aching abyss within them. These are the women who buy books like Men Who Hate Women and the Women Who Love Them, and Women Who Love Too Much, and Codependent No More. They are consumed by a hunger for relationship. A friend of ours, a young man in his 20s, was lamenting the other day about how much his mom calls him. "How often does she call?" I asked, thinking he might be exaggerating. "Every day." Whoa. Every day is too often for a mother to call her adult son who has left home.
Sadly, desolate women also tend to hide their true selves. We are certain that if others really knew us, they wouldn't like us, and we can't risk the loss of a relationship. They might be women like Tula in My Big Fat Greek Wedding, who literally hides behind the counter when an attractive man walks in her cafe. She hides her beauty behind big glasses and a day of contacts, baggy outfits, frumpy hair, all chosen because they do not draw attention, because she does not believe she is worth paying attention to. Desolate women might be busy women who hide behind, "There's so much work to do." That's how the women in my family learned to handle life. My mother grew up in rural North Dakota. Her parents spent all the long years of their lives in the same house that she was born in. Her father was a cold, detached man. He never spoke the words that little girls long, no, need to hear. She never heard from her father that she was precious or pretty. He never even told her that he loved her, not once. After one terrible day at school, she ran home with tears streaming down her face, deeply hurt, sobbing, with her little girl's heart broken. She risked running to her father for comfort. He pushed her away. Her mother, she knew, loved her. Yet she was not expressive either, but she was clean and incredibly controlling. My mom was not allowed to have friends over to her house to play because they would mess it up. The living room was not for living in, but for looking at. All objects in the house belonged to her mother, and it was not okay to touch them or, heaven forbid, move them. You can imagine, there was no romping in that house. There was no fort building or game playing or dashing about. It was orderly, neat, and soul-killing. One day, while her mother was entertaining guests, my own mother was upstairs using the bathroom. A very good girl, she washed her hands in the sink after first closing the drain as she was taught. Then a very bad thing happened. She could not get the water to turn off or the plug to open. Both were stuck. In a house of rigid rules, one did not interrupt one's parents while they spoke with adults. My mom didn't know what to do. The water ran on. Something was broken. My mom was responsible. She was going to get into trouble. The water was rising. So my mom did what we all do when we are afraid that we have failed and are going to be found out. She hid. She left the bathroom, went into her bedroom, crawled under her bed, and there she stayed, hiding, cowering, afraid. The water in the sink finally overflowed, spilling onto the floor, soaking through the ceiling, and dripped onto her mother's guests. Oops. Her hiding, like our hiding, only made matters worse.
I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. Genesis 3:10.
One of my college roommates was a very pretty young woman, but she didn't know it. She was kind and funny, intelligent and bright. She was also timid and afraid. She spent her evenings camped out in front of her personal television. Declining invitations to go out, she stayed in night after night, the weeks turning into months. Wounded, heartbroken in ways I could only guess at, she found solace in sitcoms and snacks. Too insecure to enter into the world, she hid from it instead, venturing out only to attend classes and restock her food supply. Hiding women are those of us who never speak up at a Bible study or PTA council or any kind of meeting, who when we pass a beautiful dress in a window say to ourselves, "I could never wear that." We stay busy at family gatherings and parties we can't avoid. We'd rather go to a movie than out to dinner with a friend. We don't initiate sex with our husbands ever. We dismiss every compliment. We relinquish major decisions to others. Like Eve, after she tasted the forbidden fruit, we women hide. We hide behind our makeup. We hide behind our humor. We hide with angry silences and punishing withdrawals. We hide our truest selves and offer only what we believe is wanted, what is safe. We act in self-protective ways and refuse to offer what we truly see, believe, and know. We will not risk rejection or looking like a fool. We have spoken in the past and been met with blank stares and mocking guffaws. We will not do it again. We hide because we are afraid. We have been wounded and wounded deeply. People have sinned against us and we have sinned as well. To hide means to remain safe, to hurt less. At least, that is what we think. And so by hiding, we take matters into our own hands. We don't return to our God with our broken and desperate hearts. And it has never occurred to us that in all our hiding, something precious is also lost, something the world needs from us so very, very much.
Indulging.
Whether we tend to dominate and control, or withdraw in our desolation and hide, still, the ache remains. The deep longings in our hearts as women just won't go away. And so, we indulge. We buy ourselves something nice when we aren't feeling appreciated. We allow ourselves a second helping of ice cream or a supersized something when we are lonely. We move into a fantasy world to find some water for our thirsty hearts. Romance novels, a billion-dollar industry, soap operas, talk shows, gossip, the myriads of women's magazines all feed an inner life of relational dreaming and voyeurism that substitutes, for a while, for the real thing. But none of these really satisfy, and so we find ourselves trying to fill the remaining emptiness with our little indulgences. We call them bad habits. Brent Curtis calls them our little affairs of the heart. They are what we give our heart away to instead of giving them to the heart of God. We daydream our way through traffic. We imagine meaningful conversations or difficult ones where we speak brilliantly. We spend our imaginations on cheap novels, picturing ourselves as the beautiful heroine, winsome, pursued, beautiful. We are endlessly creative in our indulgent pursuits, our adulteries of the heart. Certainly, we do not limit ourselves to just one. Take a moment and consider yours. Where do you go instead of to God when the ache of your heart begins to make itself known? Spending too much money? Gambling? Binging, purging, shopping, drinking, working, cleaning, exercising, too many movies, sitcoms, talk shows, even our negative emotions can become indulgences. When we camp our hearts in self-doubt, condemning thoughts, or even shame because those emotions have become familiar and comfortable, we are faithlessly indulging rather than allowing our deep ache to draw us to God.
Unfortunately, our indulgences make us feel better, for a while. They seem to work, but really only increase our need to indulge again. This is the nightmare of addiction. But it goes far beyond drugs. We give our hearts to all sorts of other lovers that demand our attention, demand we indulge again. We taste something that we think is good. Our longings cease to ache for a minute, but later we find ourselves empty once more, needing to be filled again and again. The ways we find to numb our aches, our longings, and our pain are not benign. They are malignant. They entangle themselves in our souls like a cancer, and once attached, become addictions that are both cruel and relentless. Though we seek them out for a little relief from the sorrows of life, addictions turn on us and imprison us in chains that separate us from the heart of God and others as well. It is a lonely prison of our own making, each chain forged in the fire of our indulgent choice. Yet, our lovers have so entwined themselves with our identity that to give them up feels like personal death. We wonder if it is possible to live without them.
We need not be ashamed that our hearts ache, that we need and thirst and hunger for much more. All our hearts ache. All of our hearts are at some level unsatisfied and longing. It is our insatiable need for more that drives us to our God. What we need to see is that all our controlling and our hiding, all our indulging, actually serves to separate us from our hearts. We lose touch with those longings that make us women. And the substitutes never, ever resolve the deeper issue of our souls.
Eve's lingering fear.
Every woman knows now that she is not what she was meant to be, and she fears that soon it will be known, if it hasn't already been discovered, and that she will be abandoned. left alone to die a death of the heart. That is a woman's worst fear, abandonment, isn't it? Rather than turning back to God, reversing the posture that brought about our crisis in the first place, which Eve set in motion and which we have repeated ad nauseum, we continue down that path by doing what we can to secure ourselves in a dangerous and unpredictable world. And down in the depths of our hearts, our question remains unanswered. Or rather, it remains answered in the way it was answered so badly in our youth. Am I lovely? Do you see me? Do you want to see me? Are you captivated by what you find in me? We live haunted by that question, yet unaware that it still needs an answer. When we were young, we knew nothing about Eve and what she did and how it affected us all. We do not first bring our heart's question to God, and too often, before we can, we are given answers in a very painful way. We are wounded into believing horrid things about ourselves. And so, every woman comes into the world set up for a terrible heartbreak.
To continue, please insert the next CD.